tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about. Episode 22, Magic. So Hans and Gabriel and probably Mr. Farley a little bit later. We're going to see if we can hot add him into the podcast a little bit later on. Before we go into things like news and covering off some updates from last week's show, a couple of things that we want to talk about. Hans, I think you want to talk quickly about a GigaOm cloud and container survey?
Yeah, so our friends at GigaOm Research called me, sent me a note on Twitter DM and said, could you give us a call out for a survey they're doing, experience with cloud and containers. We are going to put the link in the show notes. By the way, while we're at it, I do like to have some feedback of the listeners. Do the show notes work for you? One of the things we have been thinking of is making them into a WordPress blog so you can get an email with it. So give us some feedback on how the show is organized. So back to the survey, survey on GigaOm Research. I haven't done the survey myself, but it experience with cloud and containers. That's about it. And the survey goes till February 24th. I will put the link in the show notes.
Cool. I ran through it. It's actually fairly pretty extensive. And worth probably going through just to kind of see what they're trying to ascertain in this space and in turn deliver something like that to their customers. You know, obviously GigaOm is a media publication, but they do have a research arm for paid research. So there's a lot of value in them doing this.
I do like some of the research that they come out with as well, actually. They're one of the better research houses, in my personal opinion. I'll take the survey this week, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit on next week's show as well, see if there's anything interesting that we think, any trends, anything like that. Okay. Hey, Hans, can I give some feedback as well on the LinkedIn group that we've got for In Tech We Trust at the moment?
That was a great...
Wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the best discussion we've had so far last week.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think, well, I got a ton from it. And it was just great how loads of people chimed in. Hopefully we can have interesting topics like that after every week, because I really did think that was very good. Yep. Now, one other thing that we want to plug, the Tech Unplugged event on the 22nd of April in London, ran by Enrico Signoretti. Yourself, Hans, and I are both going to be presenting there. So I think I'm like the breakfast slot, the 9 o'clock slot on the 22nd, talking about containers and stuff like that.
What else?
I know, yeah. What have you got on your agenda?
The hype in hyperconvergence. And I'm closing the day with a panel session.
Okay. And while there, maybe not on the same day, maybe on the 23rd, we're thinking at the London VMUG, we're going to record a live podcast as well, yeah?
Yes. So for now, we're still arranging some technical details. I have scheduled... It was by accident, by the way, that the Tech Unplugged event was scheduled the day right before the London VMUG. But it is good. It's one of the better VMUGs that I know. It's absolutely one of the best teams that I know within VMUG. Very good quality each and every single time. Very well organized. And we're trying to figure out when throughout the day that we could do a recording of the show in one of the side rooms. So not as an actual VMUG session, but with a small audience, with a small live audience and a couple of VMUG guests.
I think that'll be a good show as well, so that'll be great. So if you're in London or the area, 22nd of April, you're interested in enterprise technology, infrastructure, all the cool stuff that's happening, you want to get together with a bunch of people that love it and talk about it, come and join us, Tech Unplugged, 22nd of April, London.
Yeah, well, actually, you say a couple of interesting people. You only mentioned Enrico, you and I, but we also should mention Martin Glassborough, Chris Evans, and Stephen Foscat. So with the six of us, I think we can pull off a nice day.
Totally. Those are the guys that are going to pull the crowds in as well, not you and me.
Yeah.
I think, actually, something that Mark Farley said, maybe it was on Slack or Twitter during the week, I can't remember. Oh, it was last week's show, I think. He said some of his favorite people in the whole industry, yep. And I couldn't agree more, actually. I think I respect like massively everybody that's going there. And I know some of the vendors and some of the people that are coming along to be there as well, top-notch people. So should be a good day.
Yeah, it's going to be not a big room. It's fairly small audience.
We were thinking 50-ish, something like that?
Between 50 and 100. But I know there's already people from the Netherlands and Italy that have signed up to come over, so that's going to be great.
Looking forward to it. Now then, some updates based on last week's show. We talked an absolute ton about VMware. I mean, they did have themselves an absolute ton of announcements. Some follow-up from last week's show before we get on to like news and things from this last week that's just gone. So some false information out there. Who wants to take that? Well, or correction of false information, should I say?
Yeah, so one of the things that VMware knew they were having a big show and there were going to be a lot of features, and the beta has been out there for a while. They said it was an open beta, but you couldn't talk about it, so it was still under NDA. There were a lot of people involved. There were also a lot of iterations of the beta, and there have been things changed between the last released beta and the current status. So there were a ton of blog posts out there. They kind of pushed this a little bit to get blog posts out as well, so that's why there were a lot of tweets, blah blah blah. There was a lot of misinformation, or I actually should say information that is currently not correct anymore. And they had this whole blog post with small things that are no longer relevant.
No, I mean, you know, Christian Mohn put it out there as well at Hubble, right? And a few others have poked at that. It's like, you know, here's a 10,000 user kind of pseudo open beta. And their point essentially was that, you know, quote unquote, everybody's under NDA, but everybody's going to leak stuff. Everybody's going to play with this and play with some of the features, and nobody's going to know exactly what goes into the final release until it's actually released. So you're going to get almost a disinformation campaign based on the features and functionality that people have been playing with in the beta. So it's kind of a marketing fail, and I think several people, I mean, Hans, I think you might even commented on it yourself, that it's, you know, you're having a disconnect there between what you've given to the ecosystem, and it's a large ecosystem, and what ultimately gets into the final release of the product. And so you're constantly going to have to go back and revision it, and I think they might have pissed some people off in the community by doing it that way.
I think so. I always look at how Microsoft does that, and Microsoft does a very open beta versions, and they allow people to talk and blog about it, and they get a lot of feedback. And that's why everyone says, well, why does it take you 2 years to bring a next release? Well, it's because everything's done in public. You either do it that way, you say everyone speaks about it, or you do it in a close group and you work with... If you do a closed beta, it's more about feedback, really feedback into the product. If you do it an open beta, it's more to let people speak about it. Doing an open beta with a couple of thousand people and not allowing to speak them about it, it's kind of weird. And I think what pissed the bloggers most off was that there was no communication between that last beta and what has been changed till today. So they had no clue that there were mistakes in their blog posts.
So do either of you think there were any major misinformation pieces out there? Because I read the blog post that was correcting it.
Yeah,
and
it was small stuff.
It's details.
Yeah, was maximum numbers of VMs in a cluster, C# details on what version of hardware you can see in what client, supports for SQL servers, blah, blah, blah. It were actually all quite minor, except if that detail, of course, is for you a yes or no to buy it or do a next upgrade.
I do think that there are some aspects, though, that get, you know, in the rumor mill of things that get released in the very early phases of the beta versus towards what gets released in the end. Like, you hear rumors of, well, depreciation completely of the C# client, right? Or, you know, you can only run the Vicasa now as the management portal, and, you know, things moving from Flex to HTML5. You know, there's all this stuff that floats out there in the ecosystem. And I think a lot of it's kind of like somewhat wishful thinking. And then there's obviously a bunch of pushback, and then people blow up. I mean, I've been in actually customer sites where a customer told me, it's like, well, the C# client is no longer going to be supported in vSphere 6 because that's where our VMware rep told us, and we're going to have to move off of Windows as the vCenter server, and your product doesn't support that, and yada yada yada. And all it does is it stirs up a huge pool of disinformation. And I would like them to be a little more open on what some of the roadmap is. I mean, because come on, really? I mean, do we have to have this giant NDA roadmap that, you're putting NFS 4.1 support, however hobbled it is, in the solution? Is that the big deal breaker that's going to, it's like, people are going to freak out about that? Come on. I mean, it's a hypervisor. I can understand keeping some parts of that technology or some things under wraps. But to put a teaser site on your web page, just come back on February 2nd, we're going to have this big announcement. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're announcing vSphere 6.
Yeah. 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 You know what? Is it the antithesis to the whole open source movement and everybody that seems to be developing stuff out in the open these days? Because there's so much software out there that seems like it's in perpetual beta and sometimes in alpha, and you're like, you're pulling your hair out, and they're saying, well, we're being open, we're developing out in the open, we're sharing everything, you can join the mailing list, you can talk to us on GitHub, wherever, right? Is this the exact opposite, where it's like, we keep everything closed and shh, don't tell anybody, and we'll do this big old huge announcement, and then it's like
I'm still okay with the way that VMware does this. It's just that it was not well executed this time.
So what I'm pointing back to is that this is the first time they've kind of had what I would consider an open beta. As a vExpert, I've been part of betas in the past that were highly prescriptive, highly controlled. There was a ton of feedback and give and take between the beta team and the people who were involved in it. And this is the first one where they were kind of really open with a lot of it. And I think that's the disconnect between the two, where, you started to get too much information leak out there instead of a much more controlled and prescribed. You either have to do fully open or fully closed. You can't have this half-ass in the middle type of solution, because all it does is it generates a bunch of confusion.
Yep. So what's the value of a closed beta then?
You can protect your intellectual property in a closed beta if you're doing it that way. But also, I think we're at the point now where, we shouldn't expect a whole bunch of surprises in the hypervisor. The things that we should be surprised by are actual new products that are coming out, mm-hmm. right? And so VMware Integrated OpenStack or, the move from VCD to VCAC to vCloud Air or whatever it is, these different products that are being either rebranded and relaunched or totally new, those are the type of things that you want to pop. But we all know that another hypervisor is coming in. There's going to be changes to, some of our standard processes or standard functions. It's going to go, the speeds and feeds are going to increase. And we get the monster VM that nobody really runs, all of these different things. But there's things you want to spin around your campaign of what your message is going to be when you do a product launch. Yeah.
That's why I was kind of disappointed in the biggest event ever. Yes. Feature wise, the amount of
the number
things, the number of new things was the biggest launch that I can remember in a while. But there was nothing really, really exciting that was like, wow, this is something. There's nothing outside of next iteration that they focused on. I mean, like the OpenStack stuff. It's something that happens in the background. They're not even focusing on it. And I lost that. I hoped for a little bit of that surprise, and it wasn't in there for me. That's why I said I was disappointed in the event as such. I'm not disappointed in the amount of iteration that is in V6. Absolutely not.
It's interesting because I was at PEX this year, and from what I've heard, it's going to be one of the last, if not the last, partner exchanges they're going to have. That's another rumor that you hear.
Yeah, we covered that.
It was very, very subdued, very mellow PEX, and I think it was just because people already knew what to expect to be announced.
Hans, I want to pick up on something that you mentioned earlier. You said that we, and I quote, I think, were pushed to push out blog posts and things like that. When you say we, are you talking about just the community in general?
No, or were you experts? I mean, the people that get some, like the experts, we get some prior information And of course, the marketing and the community drivers, they ask us, are you going to write some blog posts? The people that were planning to write blog posts, they could give their blog post up front. They were reviewed. Not that they would tell you to change stuff, but if they were blog posts that were really positive and helping to drive the message, they would drive it for you as well with the launch.
Oh, okay. I see. So
that,
okay.
It's the first time that I've known them kind of pushing, and I'm not really going to use the word pushy, but it was really close to, right?
Yeah, they're treading a fine line there, in my opinion, when you're kind of applying pressure, when you're leaning against people to write about your product. I don't know how cool I am with stuff like that. And you know
what?
I think
with that, because they asked me, are you going to write some stuff on a V6 launch, blah, 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 so we can help drive traffic. And I replied I'm actually not in the beta, so I'll leave it there and I'll see what comes out of it. And they dropped it. So there was no – that's why I'm saying I don't want to say pushy. I don't want to say they overpushed it. But they did ask every single one, and they wanted to have a lot of blog posts. They wanted it to be a big release. And I think that has come out like they wanted it.
Okay, fair enough. Just a quick kind of tangent, talking about the open versus the closed beta. Release cycles, okay? So this idea of, you know, having a product release, I don't know what, like every 2, maybe 3 years or whatever. I remember thinking a week ago when I first heard that Windows Server vNext was being pushed out to next year, to 2016, yep. Just thinking to myself, that kind of release cycle for a product feels right now so last year.
No, not at all.
No?
No, not at all. I mean, you're not speaking about products that still need to grow out of the egg, like an OpenStack and a Docker. They need those fast cycles, a VMware, a Microsoft. They need stability in the market and in the enterprise. Customers really, really don't want you I mean CIOs and managers, they don't want their engineers to come every 4 or 5 months with I have a new update for the whole infrastructure. They want stability, and they're okay with, well, let's see what comes out of the next release. We've got half a year, 2 year to maybe 2 year to prepare everything, because don't forget, it's not only the vSphere release, it's also everything else. It's data protection, it's networking, it's firmware, it's blah, 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 blah. There's a lot of preparation that comes into a major upgrade.
I'm
definitely okay with releases that are over a year in between each other.
I just think there's an argument, at least, for incremental updates that are really easy to bite off as a customer, rather than these kind of, okay, 2 or 3 years time, we've got this huge old upgrade to go through, and there's maybe changes in the way that processes work, and there's API changes.
We have the update 1, update 2, update 3 in between versions.
Yeah.
That's where the bugs are, get out of it. That's where the small stuff gets added or removed. There's major releases, and then there's updates. And the small updates, we do get them. And they're not the same releases as you have in a Docker and an OpenStack. I get that. But they need bigger releases because they're still growing out of the egg.
Yeah.
One contrary viewpoint to this, though, is shorter release cycles versus longer ones. Large customers have a hard time qualifying a platform. I run into a lot of customers who need to qualify a platform, and there's so many different moving pieces in that organization for this app or this app structure that it takes them 6 months to qualify something. So if you have this hyper, a quarterly based release cycle, they're never going to be up to speed. And in many instances, a lot of organizations I've talked to says, yeah, we purposely stay 2 releases behind whatever's current because of such a thing, right? And, I think it depends on what part of or what product you're updating. If it's a small piece of software that maybe 10% of the people in the organization use, yeah, you can have a little bit of a different one. But if it's something that really impacts your infrastructure as a whole, then if you have this constant release cycle, large organizations may shift to something else if that becomes a problem. Because when you have 10,000 servers or 1,000 servers or 1,000 assets to manage, Nobody wants to come in on the weekend and do that every 6 weeks or every 4 months.
Yeah, get it. And I think we've talked in the past, haven't we, that it's potentially one of the barriers to OpenStack adoption in the enterprise, that really fast release cycle. Anyway, also following on from last week, vSAN, whatever version it is, 6.0, right? The all-flash version, apparently a 60% uplift on cost if you want all-flash. Is that right?
Yes, and that is ridiculous. So the only thing that changes, and I specifically asked just to make sure that I wrapped it all. It's the only thing that changes is that it's coming from a 70-30 read-write cache ratio to a 100% write. I know it's a big change from 70 to 0 or from 30 to 100, but that's not a 60% uplift in licensing worth. This is so you have to buy the regular vSAN license, and then you have to buy an uplift of 60% on top of that to get an all-flash version. This is ridiculous.
Now, I'm disappointed with that because I do think that vSAN 6.0 looks kind of interesting, actually.
Yes.
Looks like it's starting to mature, get a better product. But we're in a day and age, right, where the all-flash vendors are all talking about flash at the cost of disk. And this is not, so far as I can see.
What I read into that is we were going to make it cost prohibitive for you to do this, so go buy an Extreme IO.
Not at all. Come on,
a 60% uplift to do an all vSAN. What is the engineering feat that needs to be done to do that, other than
that's right? That's what I said. That's why I specifically
asked. It's ridiculous.
Maybe a little bit in the offload. I think there was something with the offloading to the second tier, which makes sense because you're changing the structure of the caching. But it's the only thing that changes. It's the cache that changes from a 70-30 to a 0-100. That's the only thing that changes. That's not even an extra feature. It's a switch.
Yeah. If I'm a customer, I'm going to give them the finger, and then I'm going to go buy Pernix, and I'm going to leverage my old legacy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just don't understand the reasoning behind that. You know, it's just like there's so many different lead trial balloons that get floated out from VMware these days. It's going to be one of these things where they're going to have to, like, they're going to get the outrage from the customers. Or maybe it's a case where they're just not running into that many people who want an all-flash-based vSAN.
We shouldn't even be having this discussion. This shouldn't even exist, this uplift, at all. This should be a one-prize vSAN. Done. I can get an all-flash for the price of the hybrid. No. It's ridiculous.
The problem is, though, these companies, and I'm not being negative towards them here, but they're always looking to squeeze that extra dime out of their customers. At the end of the day, you know, the people that make the decisions there, they are all about maximizing the amount of cash they get from customers. So I don't think we should be surprised. Here's a question, though. Is it potentially because vSAN 1.0 was, like, ridiculously cheap? And this is just bringing it into parity with
the... Was it really cheap, though?
It was not even cheap at all. If you combine everything you need to build a vSAN, it's the same price as you're doing it with regular hardware or the regular solution that is already out there. It's on par. The price is on par. It's not even cheaper. It should have been 20 to 30% cheaper as building it on your own, but it wasn't. The price was on par with existing solutions, and that was just the 1.0.
But not on 6.0. We're not on par anymore. That's what we're saying.
Yeah, okay. Now it's
on par with the Symmetrics. Sorry.
End of discussion.
Yeah.
I was in a saucy mood today, and I tweeted out Voracleware.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was just I'm like, really?
Yep.
Is that the route you want to take? Do you want to become, like, there was a great post. There's a guy who runs FlashDB. I don't know his name off the top of my head. He was talking about how if you wanted to go to the current crop of licensing for Exadata platform and you wanted to fully max the thing out, it was $10 billion.
What?
The craziest thing I'd ever seen. I'm like, wait a second. And, I'll have to post the link and put it in the chat. I mean, if anyone was interested in it. But it was like some ungodly. I'm like, that's how Larry's able to buy islands.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
It's that kind of craziness, and you kind of, you know, it's like I saw something tweeted out today too about, well, it's great to see that the average customer at VMware has now got a 14-to-1 server consolidation. I'm like, dude, I was doing 14-to-1 server consolidation back in 2009. You know, you get this broad group of, you know, data sets that reach back across these different areas, and it kind of perverts how they present some of their thinking. If you look back to the VTax, they were saying back then when they were putting that out that it was a 5-to-1 average server consolidation ratio.
Good grief.
And I don't remember anybody who had that low of a consolidation rate at that time.
Yep.
I was doing 35 or 40-to-1.
It's averages, right? There's still
right.
I know solutions where there's a 1-on-1 just to mobility of virtualized environment.
Yeah, I know lots of customers. I mean, banks especially who do, you know, one vCPU to one core. So, you know, they don't take advantage of some of those things.
One VM per host. I've seen that in SQL servers where the app team says we need full resources and the infra team says, well, we need the mobility of virtualization. The compromise was 1-on-1. I still see that out there.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
So that averages out those 35 per host or per CPU against the 1-on-1s.
Let's move it on as well then, gents. One last thing, I think, following on from last week's show. VMware Integrated OpenStack. Very interesting, and we did have that good LinkedIn discussion about that. A bit more information has maybe come to light in the meantime, though. Looks like it needs NSX. Ouch.
Let me address that, because I mean, Mesh wrote an article about that. I'll pull up the link and put it in there. It's a Videodrome or whatever his website is. I cannot remember it off the top of my head, and I'm a horrible friend. But he was going through and looking at the fact that to do that, you definitely needed to leverage the NSX platform in order to get the full benefit to it. And then a secondary aspect, what he found, was that, well, also in supportability, you have to have 50 sockets of licensing in order to get support for it. So I'm trying to find out what the disconnect is between, like, let's say I'm a VMware customer and I'm an Enterprise Plus customer and I want to play around with VMware Integrated OpenStack, can I actually do that without having to have NSX and without having, if I want to get just basic support or something like that, do I have to buy 50 sockets of support license?
I mean, you can do it without support, right?
But you can definitely do it without support. And it's not that expensive. You look at the support, $200 per socket, that's not bad. And if I had a four-host solution I was playing around with, and I'm an enterprise, I'm more than happy to pay that, right?
But
and,
50 you know, sockets is a different story.
But 50 sockets is a different solution. You know, Mesh's point was that to do it, you needed something like $60,000 worth of MSRP-based licensing. And, you know, on Twitter and a few other places, we saw some of the people involved in that say, you know, well, our customers are going to vote with their wallets. And then these times, I'm like, they're going to have to. And then even if they do, how are we going to even know? Because it's not like they publish, you know, well, we have 500 customers on VMware Integrated OpenStack that are paying for support until it's successful. If it's not, you'll never hear about it again. And, you know, Ken Way and several others have gotten on board in that discussion. It's a good discussion, and it's kind of an extension of something that's happened on Twitter and at the same time on a few blog posts and a few time and as well as the LinkedIn group. It would be great to pull it all together, or at least I would love to do an episode and get like four or five people on and just talk about that strategy and what that looks like for a customer and get rid of some of the misconceptions, because I think that's what's hurting more than anything else, just the same way we are seeing with the miscommunication of information coming out from people who are part of the beta. You're seeing a little bit of misconception with a product that isn't quite GA yet, and until such a time, people have to speculate. So you announce something, everybody has 6 weeks or, you know, 3 months or however long to speculate about it, and bad information gets out there. It would be better if they would just release kind of like a base set of release notes and information on it when they actually announce the product, so people don't get confused.
I agree with that. So let's end our own speculation on it here. Great points, though. We'll move on and talk about hyperconverged infrastructure, right? Something that we actually wanted to talk about on last week's show but just ran out of time. EMC... VSPEX, VSPECS Blue? Who wants to take that?
VSPECS Blue.
VSPECS Blue, yeah.
It's EMC's, not really answer, but they're playing the Evo Rail. It's their Evo Rail version. What I do like about it, and something we don't see from all other partners in the Evo Rail, as we have another one in the news this week, is that they actually, EMC... did take the work to add value and put some of their their management software on top of it.
I think those guys, they think it's going to be big, don't they? And they've clearly put some effort into making this a decent product. And I like what you said there, Hans, the value they've added. You know, this isn't just some overnight, oh, let's cobble something together. It's proper what I would expect from EMC. It's a professional offering.
It's not a me too, right? Yeah, you know, exactly. If you look at, and so they have, you know, they're going to have a vSpecs Blue Marketplace. And I interviewed Chad Sakic at PEX, and we talked about it for Engineers Unplugged. We talked about, you know, what the value add is. And he lays it out very succinctly. Like, you know, hey, if you're a customer and you have 1,000 virtual machines or lower, we have vSpecs Blue that we want to push on you because we think that that's a great solution for that type of customer. If you're bigger than that, hey, guess what? We have VCE and vBlock, and that's the direction we will take you in that particular hyper-converged infrastructure versus hyperscale or rack-based converged infrastructure. And those are two very valid scenarios for them to go to market with their hybrid cloud solution, all the other things that you see EMC transitioning to, kind of like the way you see Bruce Jenner transitioning. And that's a joke for Americans.
Yeah.
but in reality, though, if you look at the other Evo platforms, I'm bought it, because HP announced theirs today or this week, and I'm like, wow, you released the exact same thing that Supermicro did. Where's the value in that? And it's almost like it was just kind of like a checkbox. And I think you'll see the same thing with some of the others. And I'm waiting for some of the others like Hitachi and Fujitsu and Dell and those to see what their hyperconverged or their Evo solution looks like based on EMC setting a very high bar with their channel partners to go out and sell the solution versus somebody who wants to kind of roll their own or do their own value add and pay a lot less and just buy the base bone system. And then you have some other vendors who are kind of like just kind of putting it out there and it's competing against their own fully baked internal solution. And it's just kind of almost like we didn't really want to do this, but we kind of had to.
Yeah, that's the HP release.
And it's the opposite of the EMC one, right?
Absolutely opposite. We really, really don't want to do it, but we will because VMware likes us to do it, and we don't want to be out of the play. The only people that would ever want to buy this from HP is people that have no other option than buy it from HP, and they really, really want an Evo Rail.
That's right. Harsh.
But also, too, the true thing about it is Evo Rail, as it stands alone, is it's a converged system, but I wouldn't consider it hyper-converged. And I like to make the distinction, and I know that Nutanix and Supervio both make the same distinction, is the extra value of the different points that they put on top. They integrate their own backup solution. They integrate their own replication solution. They integrate the ability to do compression and deduplication in real time or compression and deduplication. So there's a whole lot more in that traditional stack of infrastructure technology that they are replacing than just server and storage.
Well, and that's because it's their definition, because they have these extra features. I actually disagree with that. I think Evo Rail definitely is a hyper-converged solution. For me, the hyper-convergence is in the putting it all in one box and selling it that way, deploying it that way, managing it that way.
Sure.
That's where it stops for me. If you want to put additional features on top of that, that is really great and added value, but it's not really for me. You have to have 7 of these things to be a hyperconverged.
I think you have to have at least 4. At least 4.
No, please don't go there. I hope never to have this discussion on the podcast. Did you do that on purpose?
I
think you did.
Oh, Jesus. So
it worked. It's good.
Yeah.
Go on.
For the listeners. Oh, Jesus. I hope this would never happen. So for the listeners, one of the architects that I truly respect, by the way, because I like the Simplivity people so much, because they're actually also a customer of mine. And he said, can you be a hyperconverged player if you're not doing more than 4, what should I say,
technologies, right?
Technologies, verticals within
pieces of the stack, right?
And is what he went wrong is that because hyper means 4 in math, And I was like, whoa, what did you just say? And hyper does not mean four in math. It only means four when you go in dimensions. You've got three-dimensional. When you hit four-dimensional, it's hyper. But it's the only place in math where it, so he got me there, and I, well, it was a good twit piss.
Now we're getting into the Buckaroo Banzai
yes
discussion.
Exactly. So I, yes, I had to, thank you, Gabriel, for that one.
I'm sorry I trolled
you. I was so mad about that I almost wrote a blog post rant in it, and it was not worth it. So no,
but I mean, I bring it up
for the record. Yeah. Hyperconverged comes from hypervisor converged systems. It is converged on top of the hypervisor, and it has nothing to do with the number four in mathematics.
I will say this though, and I want to make sure that people understand the distinction between base Evo Rail, which is going to be like kind of ground level hyperconversions, and what some of the more advanced solutions that have been in the marketplace are offering, because I think it is a very strong point of distinction between what they offer versus, you know, if I look at an Evo Rail, a base Evo Rail system, great. That's a great building block that I can layer my choice of top or of software stacks, virtualized software stacks on top. And it's different approaches to hyperconvergence. One says, hey, we can do it all. The other says, no, we're going to give you kind of the bare bones, and you as a customer get to pick and choose. And I can spin that argument either way, in the positive or negative. And I think that's what makes this space so interesting, in the fact that there is there's kind of a set definition, but everybody gets to put their own out there. And so it allows you to get there, go in and talk to a customer and actually have a true discussion around your architecture, your value proposition, and why you believe that. And if the customer agrees, then boy, you got to fit there. And if they don't, then they might go somebody else.
But is it hyperconverged architecture if you're pulling in pieces of the stack that already exist elsewhere? So let's say you've got a replication piece of software that already works with vSphere, and you pull that into vSpecs Blue or EvoRail or whatever, and maybe you bring in like a backup technology that also stands on its own outside of the stack. If you're just cobbling pieces together, is that truly a hyperconverged architecture?
If you deliver it as an appliance, if you install it as an appliance, if you scale it as an appliance, it is a hyperconverged model. However,
throw in manage there as well, please.
Manage. That's what I meant. I mean, if you manage, okay. If you
policy
add,
driven, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
If you add one and done. If you retire one and done, and everything is built in into a single manager or however you want to do it, yes, that is a hyperconverged model. And it doesn't matter how many stacks you put on top of each other or where the features come from.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as you're not robbing the resources of the base concept of, you know, you're still here to put virtual machines on it. Like if I put 25 products into one box and I only have like, you know, 20 megahertz of compute process left over, yeah, doesn't mean no good. You have to find that subtle balance between compute, storage, and feature functionality to make it cost effective and to meet that kind of 3x TCO that most hyperconverged solutions are looking to meet, right? Because if you go through the exercises of if I buy into the full message of hyperconvergence the way Nutanix and Syplivia are pushing out there, I can achieve this 3x TCO and get rid of my backup software and get rid of my backup appliances and my WAN accelerators and all these different pieces of the puzzle, and I've bought full into the message, you can realize some significant cost savings and streamline your IT organization operations. And I've sold that vision and message to customers, and then I've sold bits and pieces where it's just the base hyperconverged model itself with just server and storage. It's just, you know, each customer is different. And I think being able to go in and have that conversation with a customer is where a lot of the value is. And that's one of the things I loved about working in that space, was that no two customers were identical, and the discussion could be completely different from one to the other. And it made it very fresh and interesting and never boring.
So to go on what is and what is not, if you give me a bunch of servers and you give me an ISO of a distributed storage that I need to install on top of it, this is not a hyperconverged solution, right? That is just running storage on top of a hypervisor. that's nothing more than that. This is not a hyperconvergence. Is more about the node-based architecture that is managed like that, and it's about the install, retire. Everything is just node-based and nothing manual in there.
I reckon you two boys could talk about hyperconverged all day long. I have two questions before we move it on. First question, right? VSpecs Blue, how come it's 100% channel only? Park that, though. The question after that is HP's offering, right? The one that has their store virtual in. Let's have a quick chat around that and why they've done that. And is there any value in that? Was that a good move from them? But first up, how come it's 100% channel?
I think because it's the kind of product that's like a VNX, and you don't see, I don't see the standard rank and file EMC sales reps going out and pushing, like, say, VNXE. And I think they look at it that kind of solution. It should be something that they shouldn't be able to hand off to a partner, get them quickly enabled on the VSpecs product, and let them go out and run with that. And in turn, they can turn around and focus on the more lucrative and the more profitable VCE type solutions, rack scale converged solutions, hybrid cloud type solutions, where they get to spend a lot more time working with the customer one-on-one. And that's the kind of business you want to take direct if you have a large services arm and if you're an organization that's transitioning to something other than just a storage company.
Yep, exactly what Gabriel said. Everything that is below 250K should not be handled by an EMC sales rep.
Okay, happy with that. Store virtual inside of HP's, I can't even remember what they called it now because they've got some horrible names for some of their products.
You guys are paying too much money to go out and deal with it.
HP really, really wants that left-hand stuff to come out and bring the money back to the bank, and they don't even want to sell the EvoRail just because they have that hyperconverged solution based on store virtual. I think it's a bad move, but it's politics, and they have focused on it. They've been focusing on that VSA for 2 to 3 years now, and it's what they're. You know what? It works in the field, and that's the worst part of it. People in the field take it. The resellers, the channel, when HP says this is a mature product because we've been selling it for 6 years, they take it and they take that to the customer. And that's why EvoRail can't work in HP and the left-hand converged system will work in HP. It's just because they take the marketing stuff they get from HP.
And it is fair to say as well, we have heard from some pretty decent sources that it seems to be selling pretty well.
Well, yeah, it's because what they focus on, and it's what they give to the resellers. I mean, I've been there. I've had that conversation. I've got those brochures and flyers from HP. Please, this is a good product that we're selling. This is what you should go into your customer with, and that's what they're selling with the left-hand converged system. They're not going to push EvoRail. I'll promise you that. HP local salespeople are not going to push EvoRail because they will not get any bonuses out of it.
I agree with that. And you know what? From a personal level, I'd actually kind of like to see the store virtual product do well because I was a big fan of it when it was left-hand and when it was brought into HP. I think they've let it flounder a little bit, but they have had a renewed effort on it recently. And I'd like to see it do well, and I think it brings some variation to the market as well.
You know what? Let me give you another one here. Windows XP was probably one of the most stable versions they've ever had.
Rock solid.
I know it was the best, but I would not be selling it today.
Don't they give the store virtual product away though?
They did. I don't know if they still do. They did up to like a certain amount of license, and then once you had more terabytes than that, then you had to start forking out for a license. I think that was to try and revitalize the product after it had been put out to pasture prior to that.
I'm not sure what has changed there, but you're paying for it in a converged system version.
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm trying to look something up, and I saw a 60-day free trial of Store Wants VSA providing terabytes. 10 terabytes.
Yeah, that's right. Right? Yeah.
So it's a try and buy. If you like it, you get to keep it. If not, all's well that ends well.
And I like that as well, actually.
I think that's a great model, right? I think that that helps. Hey, you get to try it, you can play with it. I mean, everybody in the hyperconverged space does that as well. Hey, we'll put the box in there. It's like, you like it, keep it.
Well, yeah,
it's, more power to you. We love that as a sales vehicle, because if the product works and it meets the needs of the customer, they're really reluctant to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen that at Nutanix, and I've seen it at SimpliVity, and you'll probably see it with the EMVV Specs Flu, where once it gets in the door, they don't want to, you know, it's like, oh, well, I got five other use cases for it that I can deal with.
Yep.
And it starts to spread. It's like it's a land and expand strategy.
All right, let's talk about something else then. So back to VMware real quick. VM Fork, these instant clones based on, is it the Snowflake technology? Looks quite interesting, right?
I'm interested. Spork. I mean, it's – what did you say, Gabe?
Spork. No, it's a KFC. It's a spoon and it's a fork.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, very good, yeah.
I thought I heard it. but yeah, it appears to be a project they have been working on for quite a while, and it's the next version. I think it's more snapshots than containers.
Yeah, it's a VDI play. You know, Brian Sir was talking about it on Twitter with a couple other people about how I could really see how this would work in a VDI atmosphere. I think it's improper to call it a containerization technology.
No, I think it's definitely not a containerization technology, but the way I look at it, it's potentially closing a gap in an area where containers were potentially superior. So that
yes.
ability for... you know, in the container world, to take an image and spin up 100 containers based off of that and then be really, really thin, copy-on-write technology, all that jazz, very, very space efficient. And VMs just didn't have that, and they looked bloated and very last year in that respect. If this technology is pulled off and if it doesn't come with this big old long list of, well, it doesn't work with this and it doesn't work with that, then I think they're closing the gap there on containers. And they're going, it's not feature parity, but it's, you know, they are closing that gap.
Yeah.
And I'll be keeping an eye on that and see how it goes because, yeah, I get that it's like, you know, a natural fit into a VDI workspace. Personally, I've no interest in VDI, I never really have. You know, even when I was really focusing on storage, it would just be, oh, VDI was awful. Anyway...
Well,
if you want to
look, if you look at the use cases of where containers live, and you go away from the VDI space, and you go to multi-tier applications where you have 5,000 web servers in the front, and you need to make 10,000 out of it, this makes a lot of sense because
yeah.
this is immediate copy on write, and I have 5,000 out of 1,000 before. So in that, if you don't look at the technology as such from a container, it does come into play in the same use cases somehow.
Yes.
So
and that
running,
ability to spin up more, yeah.
Yeah, the difference between a container is that when you deploy that container, it also goes back to a template or building a couple of templates on top of each other very fast to get that together. But if it's running and I can copy it immediately in memory, I mean, you're solving the same case here.
So you potentially get better VM density and you potentially get that ability to flex the number of VMs you've got in your estate up more quickly and potentially down more quickly, which has been a great thing that containers can do. So
with on top of that, everything that virtualization has already solved in the last decade.
Yes, and
so
also the VMware ecosystem. Yeah.
That's the big thing that containers don't have. Containers don't have all the problems that virtualization has solved. The isolation of hardware, the isolation of operating systems, all that stuff, all that security, all the networking stuff that has been solved in infrastructure in the last decade. Well, if VMware has that and they can bring on top of that the use case of containers, well, I think they actually make a case there.
I agree. I think it's very interesting. It's something we'll keep an eye on, definitely. You know, pulling off to a slight tangent here, I do wonder going forward with relation to containers, whether or not we'll see CPU offloads and things like Intel VT, but stuff like that for containers, if they become popular enough, you know, do we then start to see the likes of Intel and AMD saying, oh, well, we'll provide hardware assists and stuff for container-type workloads and isolation?
I guess Intel is already doing that somehow.
Yeah?
Yeah. Intel will never – they will never sleep on their laurels over something like that. That has the potential to be disruptive. They will definitely be in there somehow.
Cool. Okay, so on the topic of containers and stuff like that as well, we did see not, I don't think, a major announcement this week, but just yesterday, Docker released version 1.5. I'm kind of interested in that. I've got it running in the lab already. In fact, I updated my Swarm cluster, and that's all still looking nice and dandy. Yeah, good stuff there. One thing that I thought was interesting, right? They've published, I mean, they published it like about a month ago, actually, but they're up against this open container spec version 1. So in the past, like, Docker has never really had a properly documented container spec. It's been like the de facto standard for containers, right? But it hasn't really been well documented, and that's not great for the wider ecosystem, I don't think. But now they've finally documented what they're doing around the imaging container spec. And that is, in my opinion, totally 100% because of what CoreOS did with Rocket. So good move there from Docker. But I think their hand was forced by the guys at CoreOS.
Have you seen that news on the read-only support for IPv6? What was that?
No, so you can assign an IPv6 address to a container now. You can also, they're two separate things, you can make file systems within a container read-only, which kind of gives you that ability to just say, if you want to write data to a container and you want that data to be persistent, you can lock down where that data can be written to instead of letting an application write it anywhere within the container. So two separate things, IPv6 support for containers and read-only file system support for inside
the containers. But it was
full
IPv6 support. I didn't misread that as there were two separate things, the read-only stuff.
They were, yeah. I think you've misread that, yeah.
I somehow read, like, read-only support for IPv6. I was like, how
would that
work?
Yeah. I mean, they're inventing stuff all the time, but I don't know what they've invented there, if that's true.
While we're speaking about IPv6, this is a plug I like to do when that topic comes to mind. I don't get networking, you know that, and I don't get IPv6, still don't, but there's a really good book out there from Edward Horley at eHorley on Twitter, Practical IPv6 for Windows Administrators. I've every single time that I need to know something about IPv6, I go back to the book and it helps me getting through it. I still don't get my hands on it enough to fully understand how IPv6 works. But if you want to go in there and if you have that same issue as I have, it's a really good book to use as a...
Is there a Kindle version available?
Yes, I only buy Kindle books.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah, I
might check that out then. You know, it costs a lot of money to a lot of energy to power the servers that back all of that Kindle stuff, you know, and back Amazon and all of that. So yeah. Swings and roundabouts, right? Shall we move on to big data? There's news that Pivotal potentially ditching their Hadoop distro. What's going on with Pivotal? Does anybody feel like they can comment on that?
I followed the announcement, and I'll be curious to see what they want to do with it. I mean, I don't play so much in the big data space, and when I do, it's usually around Hadoop anyway. Our customers are looking at Hadoop implementations. So, you know, I would think that it's going to be, from Pivotal standpoint, is like, well, you know, we have a lot of expertise around intellectual property that we've acquired that we think will fit better into our strategery that we deliver to customers, right? And so you'll see, integration with Gemfire and Cloud Foundry and all these other technologies. And so I can see why it would make sense for them to go down that route. If you look at some of the other players in the space and their valuations, you know, do you get a little bit eclipsed if you're not able to bring your own special sauce or special IP to the table?
Yeah. Well, looking at the articles, and I mean, it's rumors because they haven't confirmed it really yet. Some of the rumors are that they would open source the Hadoop technologies that they've made. It would also go with lower cash income that they expected out of it. There would be, so rumors again, about 60 employees being laid off that were working on that beta stuff. So I'm not sure it's a positive move they chose themselves. It looks a lot like the Citrix with Zen Server story all over again.
Yeah.
Well, you know, too, I think if you look at, you look at when that announcement was for the layoffs was back in November, and I think the good portion of those people were sales reps. So it could just be a matter of let's streamline something, then let's kill it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We have duplication of effort here. Where these people are overlays of overlays. Let's be more frugal with our dollar.
Yep.
Okay.
Because if you look at some of the people they've brought on since, you know, you got Josh McKenty, you have, I think Cote just went over there, a whole slew of a brain trust. So they do there's a Cloud Foundry After Dark on Sundays. It's a good online show to watch. I watched my first episode this week, and it is my God, it's the brain trust, from over the Pivotal Group. And it's great. It's great to sit down and listen to that direction, the direction, and see what they're working on, because I don't think that's something that necessarily gets out in the vast majority of the public for people who are not focused on that on a day-to-day basis.
No question that they have some of the smartest in the same room there. Absolutely not. There's a difference between a development project and running it as a business, right? And I think that's somehow where the two conflict here.
Potentially, yeah. Also, in the same big data space, and I want to be careful how I pronounce this. HDS are acquiring Pentaho. I'm going to go Pentaho. Interesting or not interesting?
Are they going to build their own Pentaho box?
Oh, come on.
What was the thing that EMC built that nobody bought? My brain's just not working today. They had that big data analytics box that they tried to sell. Green Plum. That's it. And, you don't hear anything about Green Plum anymore, do you?
Well, I think that's one of the things they're potentially looking to open source, maybe to give an extra kick of life into it, I think.
Hitachi open sourcing?
Yeah, no, Hitachi is going to be open source. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, the rumor has it was $500-600 million what they paid for it. So that's
$500-600 million is the rumor that I heard. Yeah.
Open, pretty expensive OpenStack, but you're buying expertise, you're buying people, you're buying, the technology aspect and the ability to turn around and deliver to market. And I think it's a smart move on Hitachi's part because I think, if we are these larger entrenched legacy infrastructure companies have to find ways to enact with the developer community or the DevOps community at a level that will get them interested in, standardizing on their hardware platform, but still being able to leverage some of the benefits of a somewhat open software platform to their own benefit, right? So it kind of has to be this hybrid model that allows them to really get, still feel a little bit free and not like they've completely sold out, but also get the value and the supportability that a big labeled name has behind it.
And it doesn't really look like a toy. I mean, they've been around since 2004, 2005, and apparently they have over 1,500 customers running their stuff. So with 15,000 commercial deployments, so that's not really a new toy. It's not that we're acquiring a two-year-old garage development here. It's actually a company that has been around for a while.
Yeah, and when HDS make acquisitions, I do tend to take notice.
Yeah.
Because they tend not to pick companies up willy-nilly, I don't think.
Yeah.
And they're not doing that every other week.
No, that's right.
Especially not for this money.
And it very well could be a play to move more into the Internet of Things space.
Oh, I think totally is.
This is probably an attack towards IBM.
Very possibly, or even Cisco. Yeah. Because that space is heating up. I mean, it's not something, on its face, a lot of us are going, oh, great, we can manage our nests at home and stuff like that. But would you start to look at the totality of the ecosystem involved there? We're talking trillions of dollars worth of potential business over the course of a 10 to 15 or 20 year lifespan. It's every camera that your local municipality uses. It's all of these, these smart city concepts. There's actual real value there. So
and they are big into that as well, Hitachi as an organization. Yeah,
and Japan as a culture, there's certain cultures where that type of technology space, they're going to buy onto it big time, they'll model it, they'll get it perfected there, and then they'll release it out.
Yeah. Gentlemen, we are running long. So I think, unless there's anything else, I've got two things that I want us to wrap up with. David Scott looks like he's retiring. Ah, what a shame.
I really feel bad now that we don't have Mark on the show, because Mark has been working very closely with David Scott. I've met David Scott a couple of times at the HP Discovers. I actually think I've met him while he was still CEO at 3PAR for the first time. One of the greater people in this storage industry, and I really feel sad seeing this guy leave, but I'm quite sure this is not the last we've seen of that man.
No, I think he's bound to crop up on boards, maybe advising startups and things like that.
I hope so.
Congratulations to him, though, because he's done a fantastic job there with 3PAR. Yes. I mean, not only did he rake in $2.4 billion or whatever it was, but it has been well implemented and integrated into the HP portfolio. I mean, that is the flagship. I would say the flagship storage product, but that is the flagship product of the HP Enterprise business, in my opinion.
It's the only thing they have.
That's the only product they have.
If there's besides the printer on my desk, it's the only product where I would speak to HP about, and it's 3PAR. And that has a lot to do with David Scott as a person and his whole team, because there's always, when a startup gets acquired, there's a lot of people after 1 year, maximum 2 years, leaving, going to find new startups. David Scott stayed on board at HP and shifted the whole storage team where it was necessary, worked for 2 years, 2 to 3 years, to get that 3PAR into the midsize and down market. Even after 2 or 3 years, I spoke to that man. He was still so passionate about that product and the progress he was still making within HP. This is the one of the products that was not acquired to die, and I think a lot of that is on his account.
Yeah, congratulations, David. Passionate guy, down to earth guy, successful guy. The industry will miss you, no doubt about that. Now, guys, some sad news. Lee Johns, I did know Lee, storageologist on Twitter, sadly passed away earlier this week from cancer. He had been fighting cancer for quite a while. He gave a sterling fight against it. Very sad to see Lee pass away. But, you know, he was a great contributor to the community. I enjoyed the conversations that I'd had with him. Again, I think, I'm guessing here, that Mark quite possibly had more to do with him than I did, though. Mm-hmm. Just sad to see him go, but those kind of things happen. I think he contributed to the community well, and if I can say, he blessed our lives in doing so. So it was good to know you, Lee. So on that note, as a token of respect to Lee, we won't have any Captain Dogger or any Secret Windows phone apps.